Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. Today's key interview is with a power MD couple, Tim and May Hindmarsh. They are passionate about all aspects of medicine, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Their words, we love cutting through all the BS out there and help our patients and also challenging our fellow physicians on what we are doing in healthcare. They give their history from family practice to urgent care to being frontline doctors and then hosting their own podcast called the BS Free Podcast. You'll have to check that out. We discuss their move and we discuss a lot of things about COVID and what's happening in medicine. It's a must-see interview. We close this week out with a very important synopsis and review from Dr. H, Dr. Ely, who is telling us what has happened along the way, the missteps made by the CDC, and now the very important legal action being brought against them on a federal level. It doesn't matter what state you're in, you can go to the link and support this position that's calling for a grand jury investigation of the CDC. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My topic today is trusting and letting go. I was reading from Richard Rohr's book, Breathing Underwater. He talks about the need for a trust walk, letting go and actually unlearning. This sounds tough. So he talks about opening up three spaces at once, mind, heart, and body. Wow. So for the mind, how do you open up your mind? Well, it's that opinionated mind, that judging mind, that spinning mind that I might have, and I open that up through meditation, being quiet, calming, and prayer. How about the heart? A closed heart is a hurt heart. If you've been hurt, you know what I'm talking about. How do we open that up? Well, this is the fun part, folks. You've got to get out and have some fun. Music, art, dance, getting out in nature. If you love poetry, it's poetry, and it's just plain old play. This is what opens up your heart. Have some fun. And then how about the body, opening up the body? Well, this is generally, if I'm closed down, I'm fearful, I'm defensive perhaps, I'm keeping people at a distance. And in a safe environment, we open up our body through touch, skin to skin, hugs, yoga, healthy sex, if you have that kind of a healthy relationship. These are ways of opening up your body. I don't usually quote scripture, but I couldn't help this one. 1 Thessalonians 5:23 and 24. May the God of peace make you whole. May you be kept safe in body, heart, and mind. Ready for the presence. God has called you and will not fail you. Just today, I'm sitting here getting ready to do this show, and a fellow patient of mine, the dad, walks in. How you doing, brother? He gives me a big old hug. He says, I need to talk to you. He yanks me out of the space here. We walk outside and he puts his arms around me and says, you know, God's doing some great things for you. And you need to have joy and gratitude for being given the opportunity to be in the space that you're in. Now, he knows about the fact that the board hearing is coming, 3 weeks set aside in November. There's massive things happening in my life, lots of decisions needing to be made. And at times, I would let that get to me, and boy, did I need that message. And he reminded me the story of the mustard seed. You just need the faith of a mustard seed, the tiniest seed of all, and you can move mountains. And I thought, I can do that. So I just wanted to share that with you. If you feel like you've got mountains to move or you've got obstacles that just seem too great, remember, we're called to do the work. Make the decisions that you're called to make. Be open to hearing from that higher source, right? That's all we do. We do the work and we let go of what? We let go of the results, and then everything is okay because we're not in charge. Too often I try to take charge. I hope that helps you. I share that message with teenagers when I'm in my practice, when they're stressed out and anxious about all these things coming at them. I say, you know, just give it your best. Do your part and let go of the results. Take care. Welcome, Doctors May and Tim Hindmarsh. What a privilege it is to have you on Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire.
Thank you so much for having us. We are really excited to be here. I had not realized you guys were just south of me right here in Oregon, and you guys have a podcast, BS Free Medical Podcast, that I can't wait to learn more about. We'll get to that, but give me a little bit about your background. I mean, I know you two are married, and so having a medical marriage is an accomplishment in and of itself. Share with me a little bit about your background.
Wow. Okay. So the short version is we both were born and raised in Canada, met in medical school. We did a family practice residency in Edmonton, Alberta. And then we actually got recruited down to the U.S. at the time of the early 90s when managed care was coming in. And there was a giant, shortage of primary care docs. And with all the changes to healthcare on HMOs, yeah, we got recruited to the U.S. and actually worked out well for us because Canada was also putting limitations on physicians and where they could practice at the time to try to control the rural family practice gig. So we couldn't really go anywhere other than where we had trained. So quite unhappy with the situation up there. We immigrated to the U.S. I have been here since 94. Raised our two kids and actually we practiced for 25 years in one system here, south in the Willamette Valley. Did everything we did the full rural family practice. Tim did an OB practice as well. I pulled the plug on that just because I like my sleep a little bit more and need it more than he does. But we did everything from coroner to we did all our in-hospital patient management, ICU. And then over time, with changes, we kind of got disillusioned with family practice. I pulled the plug first and switched over to urgent care in 2010, and then Tim in 2013. And so we've been doing urgent care since then in the Willamette Valley area. We've also raised our kids who are now long gone. And, you know, that's kind of where we've been. The big thing for us is we've worked through this COVID pandemic as, I would say, frontline physicians right from the get-go because of the group we were at when the pandemic started, pretty much put the urgent care doctors as the head charge, whatever, is frontline docs during the pandemic and kind of set it up so that we would be the ones to see anybody that had like a sniffle, an earache, a shortness of breath, anything. And the way things turned out, we've been doing COVID management right from the beginning. And currently we are kind of back to our roots. We're still in our little hometown here in rural America and have helped a former resident that we train set up a practice in our little hometown. And we've been treating COVID patients with no fear and lots of them. And that's kind of where we're at.
Wow. When I was reading up about your backgrounds, I noticed, Tim, for example, you've been on all sorts of committees, very, very connected with what we would have called, you know, mainstream medical establishment stuff. And May, I know you did a medical director of Starfish Medical Ministries. That interests me because I'm a missionary kid. So, I think that's cool. So when you switched, you know, when COVID hit, this was a whole brand new thing, right? For all of us. And it's interesting, my observation, and I'm learning about you two as we go here, folks. I have not done much homework to know what your answers might be like. I'm just curious. People were being told, go home, stay home, don't come to the hospital until you're ready to die, basically, short of breath. And that just made no sense to me as a physician. I mean, I'm a pediatrician. You guys do pediatrics as well. I mean, we're supposed to be taking care of the sickest of the sickest, but also preventing it. Did you get involved with America's Frontline Doctors at all? Or did you just do, when you say you were frontline, you were it?
Yeah, you know, initially, I mean, it was a journey for us. There was definitely a red pilling that occurred. And it was actually quite I'm actually kind of proud of it, honestly, because like we started doing live streams really early in the pandemic. We had literally in March, like as soon as everything, I was supposed to go to to the rock band Tool on the whatever that day was, the 12th or 13th of March, and they canceled the show. And so we all went over to my friend's house and stayed up really late and listened to music and did what we normally would do anyways. I remember having discussions like all my friends, right? Like they're all, well, this is all BS. This is nothing. It's just the sniffles. And I said, we have absolutely no idea what it is. Like, we only have one bullet in the chamber. And so about a week later, we started doing live streams. In our first Facebook live stream, we had 10,000 downloads in like 12 hours. And I'm like, holy crap, this people actually care about this. And so we went from, there's only one bullet in the chamber right now because we don't know what this is. And the only evidence we're getting is from China, which God only knows what that means. So, you know, and that bullet was isolation. So that's where we started. And we actually missed one of our friends' 50th birthday parties. We're like, we don't know how contagious this is. You know, people really shouldn't be in groups, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where we started. And so from, you know, and then we started reading. And I've probably read 1,000 hours, and I know more about virology now than I ever knew even the day I graduated from medical school. And so I started reading all across the map, and then May and I would discuss it. I mean, almost to the point where May's like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Can we talk about like vacations or something? And I'm like, no, this doesn't, you know, and a lot of stuff just started to not make sense. So I'm like, man, this really doesn't seem that bad. Like, you know, the average age of death is like 80. So if you're a male, you know, you're the milk that's 2 years past your expiration date, and then you die of a viral illness. Well, that's just called life. And I was like, you know, I started kind of going like, this doesn't make any sense. And then I started looking at the prison data, which was completely, like, I mean, there was really nothing publicized about this. And I had to dig really deep to find these articles on prison data, which was fascinating, where every single person was positive and no one was very sick. And this is back in like July of 2020.
Wow. So that was the original Wuhan strain that was supposedly so deadly.
Yeah. I'm like, they killed one guard in this prison who was morbidly obese and a little bit older. And it killed, I think, somebody else that was a prisoner that was, you know, in his 70s or something. But they tested it. Like, finally, one warden said, I've had enough. And they tested every single person in the prison. And they had like a 75 or 80% positive rate, which is what you would expect, right? It's a respiratory virus. It spreads super easy. You have all of these people like contained. They obviously can't go anywhere. They're in jail. And I was like, wow. So I guess we're all going to get it. And, you know, the susceptible people are going to potentially succumb or get really sick. But we seem to be really kind of turning our society upside down for not really a good reason. So that's where that kind of started with me. Well, then the podcast started. So we started the podcast in January of 2021. By this point, you know, with the reading and reaching out and seeing what the heck is going on, you know, we managed to get an interview with Peter McCullough early in May of 21. Harvey Risch followed Paul Alexander. By that point, we were deep into the COVID-19, email group that Peter had started. And we're like, holy man, this is crazy. Like, we've had really smart guys come up with really good treatment protocols. All of it has just been completely buried by any of these large corporate systems that we'd worked for. We've worked for two big corporate systems. We've done, you know, a little bit of healthcare work in Canada. May's done tons of mission work compared to me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're like, this doesn't add up. Well, then the vaccines came out. Well, again, I'd read a lot on the vaccines, and actually I thought the mRNA technology was really, really interesting. Not necessarily for COVID, but just the idea that you could potentially do gene therapy for things like cancer, for cystic fibrosis, et cetera, et cetera. And it actually worked. Like, they actually got, after 10 years of trying, they finally got the lipid nanoparticle to deploy its payload. I thought, wow. this could completely change the world. So we actually got vaccinated really early, which is another entire story unto itself, because we got absolutely zero effects, like no sore arm, nothing, like zero. And when we later, which was just a couple months ago, interviewed Sasha Latapova, who started, was one of the initial people to look through the "did you get a bad batch" stuff. Mm-hmm. She's like, "You got nothing." I guarantee you, I've looked at those batches, and if you had absolutely no side effects at all, then you probably got saline. And I'm like, perfect. So then what really clinched it for us is we started, we're working in an outpatient urgent care in Eugene, and we started to see vaccine side effects pile up like crazy by spring of 21. And like
every day we worked, there was something, and we just discussed it. I said, think of all the pediatrics. So he had a massive pediatric clinic because of his OB practice. Me, not mm-hmm. much. My patient base in family practice was quite different. But we said, like, look at all the years that combined the two of us just done in pediatrics. Vaccinations. How many vaccine injuries do you remember? I think we can remember one between the two of us at this point, like up to 20 plus years. And, thinking back to even colleagues. And I said, look at what's happening with this. Every day we would work, us or one of our colleagues we're working with, we'd see something come in from localized horrific rashes and reactions. And then it started. I never saw a case of POTS syndrome in my life. Sure enough, myocarditis, two cases for sure that I had seen. We were starting to see all kinds of bizarre neurologic things. I saw a nurse that did have Guillain-Barré. She actually personally said, I know this is from the vaccine. It has to be because I'm healthy. This was just 10 days ago, yada, yada. It started to pile up like crazy. And that's when, our eyes started to really open, to that. But back, to what you were asking about the not doing any treatment for patients that are sick, that's the other thing that, man, that really bothered me, and it's still to this day. Like I just find it incomprehensible what has happened. We would be on the phone with people initially before we opened back up the urgent care to see people, and it would be, well, stay at home. No, there's nothing we can do. Lay in bed, blow your nose.
Crazy, right?
Chicken noodle soup. And then finally, when we had everything open and we're in full hazmat suits, as I call them, and donning and doffing and wasting equipment between it was crazy what we went through.
Right. But the next crisis will be climate change, and we'll have caused it by all the PPE that we're burning.
we would see people, and we were basically instructed by the upper powers above us that there's nothing we can offer these people. Just, we were doing we'd be doing telehealth. So it was like, just tell them, stay at home, monitor your O2 and your temperature. And if it gets really bad, then you have to go to the ER and be admitted. And we looked at each other and even some of our colleagues, and we thought, when in the history of medicine of ever taking care of patients did we say, we're not going to do anything to help you out until we're ready to put you in the hospital? It's absurd, right? From you have a UTI or a pneumonia. Do you ever just tell a patient, well, I'm not going to try anything until you get to the hospital?
Well, but
even with the flu.
Right. But if I can interject, there's another thing here that's really super fascinating, which is, and I know that you're familiar with this, which is obviously the gigantic increase in all-cause mortality, especially in younger people, like when you look at these insurance companies and so forth. But when I think back just to, again, what did I personally see with my own eyes? What did I witness, working 35 hours a week or whatever I did in my own patients? And it was fascinating because healthcare actually matters. It probably doesn't matter as much as most of us think it does. But when you need appropriate treatment, you need appropriate treatment. And in the first probably 4 months of the pandemic, I saw more sick respiratory patients with new onset congestive heart failure than I did COVID patients. And I'm like, I'm trying to explain it to the patient. I'm like, okay, ma'am, you know, you haven't been seen by any of your providers in however long, you're in acute congestive heart failure. I mean, I'm trying to explain the gravity of the case. Like, this is very serious. Like, this is a really, you know, prognostically, this is a terrible disease to get. You don't want to have this. And they're totally relieved because it's not COVID. Yeah. And I'm like, no, no, you don't understand. You have to go to the hospital. I mean, you know, there's really effective treatment. We'll get you feeling better in just a few hours, and then we can add other meds and we can extend your lifespan and we can get you feeling way better. Well, I don't want to go to the hospital because I'm going to get COVID. And I'm like, sister, what you have is 1,000 times worse than COVID. It's congestive heart failure, for the love of God. Please go to the hospital. And I mean, and this would happen over and over again. We would do telehealth and people would be weeping, you know, like a 45-year-old man weeping because he was going to kill his family. I mean, that's what he was convinced was going to happen. I'm like, dude, you're fine. You know, you're 10 days into this, you're coughing your brains out, but your O2 sat's fine. You don't have a fever. Your body aches are gone. You got a cold. You're going to be fine. You don't need anything else right now. And it was just like, you know, and then you'd see these people where you were scared and you send them to the hospital. And by the time we were sending people, at least I was sending people regular, you know, seeing them more ill, we had gone away from the ventilator status part. So that was good news because the ventilators were clearly a death sentence.
Yeah.
No, but they would still get, thank God they got dexamethasone. They got a high flow outpatient, you know, or non-ICU oxygen, which seemed to work pretty well. But then, of course, they got remdesivir, right? You know, it's just like an entire other story. And so, you know, we didn't just kill people by shutting them in and making them alcoholics and depressed. What we did, we didn't just harm children by having them not interact with other children and play outside and do fitness activities and things they needed to do. But we also killed people because really legitimate healthcare that we've been doing quite efficiently for the better part of 100 years just ceased to exist.
Right.
And I was like,
I know.
How do you do that? Like, how do you stop people's cancer therapies because they're now elective? It's like in 2010 and 2008, during the election, you know, healthcare is a human right. Healthcare is a human right. You know, we have to have socialized medicine. We have to have Obamacare. It's the most important thing in the whole freaking world is healthcare. Well, until we say it's not. And I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah. It was a crazy level of insanity. If you think back, I imagine you have a similar experience. Let's go pre-COVID. It's winter time. We're seeing all the sickness. Kids, the sickest kids, maybe it was RSV, severe case of bronchiolitis. They're actually having O2 sat issues. We would identify what they had and, if necessary, hospitalize, but we would manage them, you know, right from the get-go, figuring out, do they have a bacterial pneumonia that needs antibiotics or not? Those sorts of things. All of that sort of just got shoved aside. It's either COVID or not.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, there's nothing else to worry about. It was insane, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. From what you're saying, I mean, it goes to the extreme. It got to the point where we were working where, like Tim said, anybody that said they had shortness of breath, a kid that had ear pain, somebody said they had a rash, they would not be seen or allowed to be seen in a primary care clinic because they're screened out because they have symptoms of COVID.
Right.
And so,
well, everything was a symptom of COVID.
Pretty much.
I drank a bottle of Jack Daniels last night and now I have a headache. It's COVID. You got, you know, well, no, you're an idiot. That's what the diagnosis. I mean, it was completely insane.
Yeah. So thinking back pre-COVID vaccine, and so we've got this pandemic there that, you know, I think you and I, we've all read the same deep dive into the actual literature and realized that it was the PCR testing with, you know, an epidemic of positive tests because of using the wrong testing technology, which made the fear mongering so possible by the news. But what did you guys actually see? Because you're in the trenches seeing the sickest kids, adults, old people. Before there was a COVID vaccine, how much death and destruction did COVID cause on your population there? I mean, you're in a mid-sized town that has, you know, I'm sure you're plenty busy.
We saw, so in October of 21, we started actively pursuing monoclonal antibodies in treating patients. Oregon Health Authority was actually really good to us because we just asked. So we did two things. We asked and we received. And number two, we took all comers. We didn't care how sick you were, whether you had the sniffles. We saw sick patients. We just said, it is our duty as physicians to see sick patients.
Yeah, but this is after vaccine.
This is after the vaccine. So we saw virtually zero death and destruction, at least from COVID. That is an important caveat. Prior to that, there was a fairly prominent person in our community that was in his mid-40s, got very, very ill, was in the hospital for several months, but somehow almost miraculously survived. One of our neighbors, who is very fit but older, got really sick, but he was fine. And that was...
Well... Yeah, that's what we had in our clinic.
I mean, but as far as our personal experience, both with patients and members of the community, that's what we saw.
There was that outbreak at the nursing home, though. Remember, that's where it seemed to all start.
Yeah, that was really, really early at the veterans home in Lebanon. They had a pretty big outbreak, but I don't even know if that killed a single person. And they had a guy in there that survived that was over 100.
Yeah.
I have not seen more death personally in my life with people close to me or associates of ours in the last 2 years than I have in my entire life. And part of it's just the demographics. You know, I'm in my late 50s now, and you know, my mother got old and died, and you know, my aunts and uncles have been dying. You know, my mother.
So you're saying you have seen more deaths in the last 2 years,
but not COVID.
No.
Like,
so
parallel death. It's the opposite train track, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like most of our peers are not even asking the question, did you get the COVID vaccine, when they see people who come in with bizarre symptoms. Is that true, or maybe I'm wrong on that? What are you seeing? Are you asking when you have a young person with myocarditis? And I'm 35 years doing pediatrics. Until COVID vaccine, I had never seen a case of myocarditis in a kid. I've had a kid hospitalized already with myocarditis. They went to the pharmacy and got the jab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I absolutely would always ask, mostly just out of my own curiosity, not out of judgment. And I'd tell them that this is not a judgment. Just be like, I ask other health questions. You know, do you smoke? You're sexually active? And I'm curious, did you get the vaccine or not? I absolutely asked. And man, with all the side effects I was seeing, I mean, it was like a total 1-to-1 correlation.
Yeah, it was fat. You know, the other thing that was fascinating with regards to the vaccine and illness was, once we start, we were getting referrals from the major health systems because we actually kind of would see sick people. Right. And they knew that we had tons of monoclonal antibodies. And so, you know, we had a guy come from Vegas. We had somebody come from Boise because they knew that they would be seen and treated that day, which was critical. It wasn't just seeing sick people. It was, you had to see them and you had to be willing to treat them when you saw them. Because some places were seeing somebody and then they might be day 5 or day 6 into their illness and they're scheduling them for a monoclonal infusion 3 days later. Well, that's just completely worthless. So we would see them and treat them that day. And we have treated almost 1,000 people. We have had maybe one or two that went to the hospital after that. But what's interesting, because I would ask every single person if they're vaccinated, is initially what we saw when we started in October is probably 75% of the people that were sick enough to require treatment were unvaccinated. Now it's the complete inverse. And this is in a county that's probably has the least number of vaccinated people, or close to it, to the least number of vaccinated people per capita in the state. So, you know, now virtually everybody that we see that would require treatment is vaccinated. And I'm like, well, yeah, because Girk Vandenbosch talked about this 2 years ago, and he's been Ezekiel with regards to his prophecies. He's been so accurate. And I think that is terrifying, honestly.
Can you share with our audience what you're talking about as far as what is it about these shots that seems to be putting people at risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a lot of stuff I learned recently. What it comes down to is two big concepts that are kind of the same thing. One is called original antigenic sin, and the other one is similar, which is like immune imprinting. So original antigenic sin is a postulate that says that the first antigenic insult you get, in other words, the first virus you get infected with in that family of viruses, is going to be how you respond essentially with memory immunity for the rest of your life. So for instance, if you got H1N1 flu, then every flu virus that you get exposed to, you're going to respond to with an H1N1 response with your T cells and your antibodies and whatnot. So the problem with that, there's two big problems. First of all, number one is you're immunizing people with an extinct coronavirus during a pandemic. That's the critical thing. Okay. So why is that a big deal? Because you're giving them the original antigenic sin insult when there's a giant selection pressure of tons of that virus in the system. So if you have a 100% sterilizing virus, like the smallpox vaccine, then you get the smallpox vaccine, you don't get smallpox. When you have a leaky or less perfect vaccine, like the coronavirus vaccine or the flu shot for that matter, and you have a huge amount of virus in the ecosystem, you're going to, by definition, respond to that viral pressure with the old antibodies from the Delta or from the Alpha strain. And by definition, you are going to push the evolutionary development of variants. And, you know, Geert Vandenbosch, who was, believe it or not, the head vaccinologist for Gates, said, you cannot, especially with a respiratory virus, vaccinate your way out of a pandemic. You'll only make it worse. You'll only push the variants. And if you're very unfortunate, you will push them to not just more contagious, but more deadly variants. And so that's the problem. I firmly believe, based on this science and listening to somebody like Gert, who's really been virtually 100% correct for the last 2 years, is the more we're vaccinating with these, even if we get an Omicron vaccine, the more we're going to push the variants and it's never going to go away. Like it's never going to go away because we're going to continue to push this evolutionary selection pressure. And that the key to stopping this now is to just say, we're done. Yep. Stop vaccinating, stop isolating, you know, treat the sick with, you know, there's approved treatments out there that are good. I think Paxlovid is terrible, but I think the monoclonals are all right. You know, we still have evidence of ivermectin, et cetera. Treat the sick, take your vitamins, lose weight, all the stuff you're supposed to do to be healthy, and we're done. That's the solution.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. This has clearly been the biggest disaster from a public health standpoint. I mean, so we're both in Oregon. We're all in Oregon. What do you think of our public health response? How is it that fellow physicians can miss it this badly? I mean, just totally ignore the actual what's happening on the ground. What the heck?
I mean, I don't know. We look at each other and we go, are we just becoming dinosaurs? And we practice this long that the culture of medicine has changed that much that, I mean, honestly, that's a big part of what we talk about is that how it just seems like so many physicians just got in line, kind of like, I don't know, The Handmaid's Tale or Lemmings or what, and just nodded their head and listened to those in power and government and said, okay, 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 this is what you say. Okay. And just, I'm like, where's the critical thinking? I mean,
right.
So a big part of me is like, is it just a selection bias in where we live in the US, and that our state being very blue in the cities tends to want to just listen to those in power? I mean, in the rural areas, not so much. And then honestly, the other thing that the shutdowns, I mean, it just seemed to follow the whole national narrative, was annoying. But what really frosted my cookies, like I like to say, is when people wanted to try things like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and would start to prescribe those. And we're not the only state to get shut down. I think there's like six others I remember hearing through, you know, RFK's book, but where the pharmacist had the power to veto us prescribing.
Right.
Right. Like
that just blew my mind.
Right. So
or even companies like Tim and I said, people going to work, you know, they, unless they were vaccinated, their employer had the power to say, no, you can't come to work if you don't follow, you know, this quarantine regulations, but we won't let you come to work if you're not vaccinated. I'm like, they're practicing medicine without a license. I mean, Tim was the first to really realize that. How can they determine who gets to put what into their body? If the doctor has written an exemption for them, whether it be a religious accommodation or a medical exemption, the employer would deny it. All these things from, I mean, that's the employer standpoint, but even when we would just talk with colleagues and other people about how we weren't even trying any treatments. We remember HIV, we'd throw everything at the book to try to see what worked. And people like, oh, no, there's no evidence. It's just, that's what the powers that be say. I mean, well, yeah, I'm still banging my head against the wall.
You know, Harvey Risch really helped rip the scales off my eyes when we interviewed him. And basically he said, look, I've been, you know, that's been my job. I've been teaching epidemiology at Harvard, or Yale rather, for, you know, a million years. And he goes, a randomized controlled trial can be made to say whatever you want it to say. He goes, that's the bottom line. And he was the first person to actually kind of remind me that when something gets peer reviewed, it's peer reviewed based on the data that the drug company gives to the peer reviewers. It's not the raw data. So this looking at the actual, you know, they tell you how they included and excluded people, et cetera, but they don't give the raw data. So it's not really peer. So nothing really is peer reviewed when you really think of it. It's peer reviewed inside the pharma, you know, the pharma's net. And you know, when I started hearing that, I was like, okay, well, why do these guys worship randomized controlled trials so much? Well, it's because they can control them. That became very clear to me in the last year. And I, you know, we got in a little bit of a debate on LinkedIn with another physician who was, you know, whining and complaining and saying you shouldn't do anything without a randomized controlled trial. Well, I found it curious that the guy was a neurosurgeon. There's not a single thing that he does for his $800,000 a year job that can be randomized in a placebo-controlled trial. You know, like, no. You cut on people. You can't hide that. And I was just like, I was just stunned. I'm like, do you not get this? I mean, what makes doctors doctors is the ability to think critically and solve problems. But we're not trained that way anymore. We're not like engineers to say, here's a toolkit of math. Go build a bridge and solve a problem. We're told, recognize a pattern and then plug yourself into the pattern algorithm and prescribe this drug. And it's nuts. Like, we are trained from day one now, little baby doctors.
Not to think
and do what we're told. That's 100% correct. And it's not particularly new. I found an article, I forget the guy's name. I tried to get him on the show, but I don't know what happened. But he wrote an article. He was a medical ethicist and a pediatrician, I believe. And it was, why were so many Nazis doctors? Mm. He went back and looked at the history. Mm. And this appeal to authority and this kind of almost military ranking that goes on in the training of physicians, I think is a real reason for that.
Yeah, no, that you make a really good point, because back when we were in residency, right, you looked up to that senior resident because you were just so overwhelmed with all the things you had to master. I mean, somebody's having a heart attack on you. They're having a seizure. You've never managed that. We had those first 2 years of medical school, basic science. We're all on the same page. It makes sense. And then you just go into, here's a disease. What do you treat it with? And it's all that pharma protocol. And they've got it down to a science, if you will, tobacco science. So you two started BS Free Medical Podcast. How did that come about?
Wow. So it really was basically born out of the pandemic. You know, for years, as our poor kids have experienced us table talking at each other throughout our whole career and lives, we always have fun discussions. We don't always agree. We debate stuff, and sometimes it's too much, probably table talk at home, and can't leave work behind. But I'm like, man, you need someone else to talk to about this. I'm done. I'm unplugging. Or we would be with friends and they would love our interaction, and they just start laughing and like, everybody should be able to hear you guys talk. This is so funny, you know? So we kind of had that in the back of our head. But when the pandemic hit, and what happened was we were supposed to go on our annual vacation to Hawaii. It was all booked April 1st. Well, pandemic happened, right? March, everything's closing. And we said, okay, we won't show up for work for 2 weeks. So we were furloughed at home. And that's when we were watching everything in the news and the media and researching. And our friends are texting and freaking out in our family. So we thought, well, let's just share what we know as we're learning it with everybody. We started doing Facebook Lives, and we started doing it every week. And I can't believe how many people we were getting right from the beginning, how many downloads. So at that time, we thought, this has been a good test, for this podcast. We talk about doing it. You know, we're doing our financial planner actually had a podcast, and he said, you guys are doing the hard version. You're doing the video. What's much easier to do audio, because you can record it, edit, et cetera. He said, so this is going to be an easy transition. And long story short, they started a network called the Doctor Podcast Network at that fall to get together a bunch of actually different-minded physicians with various podcasts, and it launched in 2021, and that's how it started. Yeah.
Huh. Fantastic. And so what are some of your favorite interviews?
Oh, yeah. So that's the fun part about our podcast. So it's called BS Free MD. And, you know, the gist of it is that it's probably, it started it with the target audience of both medical and non-medical people alike. But we really find that our audience is mostly non-medical, and we like to hone it so that, you know, it's just like talking to our patients and trying to simplify things. But the basis of the podcast is to cut to the chase of what's really happening in medicine, topics that they're really interested in, everything from the physical, mental health, spiritual issues, and, you know, what's the truth. You know, we like to present various sides, but we like to kind of cut through some of the BS that people don't understand that's out there.
You two have found life's balance, and you talk about the four F's, faith, family, finance, and fun. And I can see you have a way to just pull all that together and still, you know, be on that same path. Kudos to you both. Really enjoyed having you on the show. I want to give you the last word. We've got a large audience. What kind of, each of you maybe take a stab at what the most important message you would like people to take from this interview?
Everyone has a voice, and you have to be willing to speak up and say what you believe. Like we have finally got to a point where we don't care, you know, in other words, we don't care what other people necessarily think, because we care way more about what we believe and who we answer to. So we care so deeply that we don't care.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And so, yeah. What does that mean? You know, cause people are like, well, you know, I'm a stay at home mom and I got three kids. Well, do you ever go to a PTA meeting? Do you ever go hang out with your friends and somebody says something completely off the wall, like they're going to get a fourth jab, and you go, why would you do that? That doesn't make sense. You know, you can gently confront people and stand up for what you believe. But most of us, I think, I see this a lot in faith communities and in often sort of more genteel conservative communities, is we just sit there and take it. Well, you got to do the, you know, it's D. Snyder time and we're not going to take it. And it doesn't mean you have to be obnoxious. It means exactly the opposite. And so if I was going to, you know, this, there, a verse has plagued me during this whole thing. And it really is you have to be gentle as doves and as shrewd as snakes. And I think we need to do that as the defenders of what we see as the defenders of truth. Gentle as doves, shrewd as snakes.
Yeah, I would kind of piggyback on that a little bit, but say that, you know, this whole through this whole pandemic, and just career wise, as things have gone on, you know, patients that are not medically trained, lay people, you know, they really start to question what's going on by authority, physicians. And so I would say to that is that, you know, don't be afraid, same thing. Don't be afraid to question authority, and stand up and stand up for yourself and your community. And it might be right at the local level, at the school board, the government, because that's the only way to affect change. But don't be afraid to speak up. And, you know, so many people that we've met, as patients and just across the podcast, have been those people that have said, you know, I'm going to stand up for what I believe in and fight for the truth instead of the bigger narrative. But be your health advocate as well. So.
Excellent. So are you going to get the next booster?
No way.
Goodness. At this point, Helen Keller could see that this doesn't work.
We've also had COVID. I mean, I've had it twice, Tim.
I had it at least once.
And I'm like, we've got a really good dose of immunity. No.
Devil's advocate. One last thing. I want to see how you answer this. How could May, Tim, you two are doctors, but you're way out there. How could you be right? And you're trying to tell me that all the other doctors are wrong. That just doesn't make any sense.
You know, medicine and science, if it's science, is not based on a consensus. It's based on what's true.
The biggest question people need to ask is, why are they silencing people that want to question it? That's not science. It never was. So
it's not America.
So
no, yeah. like every time, right. I wake up and go, okay, maybe I've just drank the Kool-Aid and I'm at Jonestown and, you know, I'm listening to the preacher with the funny sunglasses. I go, well, then why, if that's the case and we're insane, why are they silencing?
Right.
Are the people that we agree with. And I go, you don't silence insane people that disagree with you. You turn the volume up to 11. You want the shrieking insane people that disagree with you to be heard with the most clarity possible. And they're doing the exact opposite. That's all you have to see to go,
yep,
something is not right here.
Something's not right. Well, nice answer. Thank you so much for that. I get asked the same thing. Even my own mother was questioning me, like, how can you be right and everybody else is wrong? And I'm like, Mom, I live in this world. This is what I do for 24/7 and have for the last decades, two, three decades. And you're going to listen to some guy on the news who's reading a teleprompter? Come on. Anyway, you guys have been delightful. Thank you so much. Folks, check out bsfreemd.com. I can't wait to go look at some of your podcasts and stay in touch with you all. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having us. It was so fun.
Absolutely.
Welcome, Dr. H. You are such a blessing to our show. You are the founder of the Energetic Health Institute. Folks, if you want to know any of the documentation that we're going to talk about, check that website out. You host a weekly nationwide program, the Energetic Health Radio. and you're a regular writer for American Out Loud, that network. You've published some incredible manuscripts. The COVID-19 data collection, that's been massive. You've got a 444, I don't know how you got the numbers to work out just perfect like that, page peer review position statement on willful misconduct. And it's called COVID-19, Restoring Public Trust During a Public Health Crisis. You can go check out the entire document. You've been a big part of calling for a congressional investigation into the CDC's violation of multiple federal laws. And most importantly, I think for today's update, your team, you've been heading this formal grand jury petition exposing these rampant acts of willful misconduct. And so, yeah, give us a little history of how you got here. From being just a health nutrition guy to kind of leading the nation and trying to hold these folks' feet to the fire.
Well, you know, thank you again, Dr. Paul, for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here. We started this on March 12, 2020, and something didn't smell right. You know, it was just like what didn't smell right was they were advocating for locking down healthy Americans. That's never been done before in human history. So when we saw that, we said, you know, there's something up with this. And then not too long after we saw while we were supposedly locked down that all these 5G towers were going up and everything. And it's like, somebody's making a move here. This is a strategic kind of move here. So I'm tracking the data out of Italy, out of South Korea, out of China, just because I want to calm people down and say, look, let's see how bad this is going to be, who it's going to be bad for, and how long it's going to last, right? And the data was really clear within a week or two, over 60 with multiple comorbidities, multiple pre-existing conditions, it would last a country about 40 days. That's that we were going to see a rise and then a fall. And as we're tracking the data for the United States, something interesting happened. As the number of new cases, new hospitalizations, and new deaths per day started to drop, there was then this secondary rise up that we hadn't seen in any other country. And I was like, what is that? Now I'm my background, once upon a time, I was a data analyst on the International Space Station. So I was like, we have to be able to explain that. And I can't explain that because it isn't happening anywhere else in the world. But when we started digging into it, it was the CDC changing how death certificates were reported, but only for COVID. And the problem with how they went about doing it is they did not report those changes to the Federal Register to open up public comment and federal oversight. So they actually broke three federal laws that we've unearthed at least to make that change. But here's what it amounts to. Did people die? Yes. But the debate is, did they die from COVID? And traditionally, when someone has pre-existing conditions, they are counted as the cause of death is the oldest pre-existing condition, not the initiating factor like the flu or some kind of infection. It's if you had diabetes for 10 years, diabetes is the cause of death. You know what I'm saying? That's how we've always done it.
Right.
So what do you need when to make the public think there's an emergency? You need dead bodies. And how do you get those dead bodies? Or the appearance. You introduce a bioweapon that's going to wipe out a specific vulnerable segment of the population. And then you make sure the recording of that death is caused by the infection and not the pre-existing condition. And the way they went about doing it was completely against the law. And so what that amounts to is criminal data fraud in our allegations and willful misconduct by elected officials, because the result of it has been disastrous across our great nation. And the result of it on the financial side of it, Dr. Paul, has led to, in our allegations, at least $3.5 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money that's been misappropriated.
Yeah, it just feels like this massive heist.
Mm-hmm. That's to simplify it, it is. It's in my personal opinion, a murder for profit scheme. And I think that if we allow something like that to go unpunished, then shame on us.
Yeah, and it'll happen again.
Rinse, repeat. They'll go to the same playbook over and over and again, and it'll just keep attacking our freedoms. It's like, at a certain point, we have to have the same courage our forefathers, our ancestors have and said that freedom is worth fighting for. And so that's what we're doing, thanks to the help of a tremendous team that I have, and especially Senator Dennis Linthicum and Senator Kim Thatcher and Attorney Steve Jonkis. I mean, I am blessed, and people like you, I'm blessed to be around so many great Americans who believe in freedom. We love freedom, and we're willing to fight for it. And that's what the fight is right now.
Yeah. So give us an update. What's going on with the formal grand jury petition?
Okay, so we filed on March 7th in federal court a very unprecedented case. We are not asking the judge to deliberate on the merits of our case. We are saying, Your Honor, it's your duty when presented with this information to get it before a grand jury. Why? Because we went to every single U.S. attorney in the country and were basically ghosted. We went specifically to the Department of Justice, same thing. They told the senators to kick rocks. And so what ends up happening is the defendants, we informed a gentleman by the name of Scott Asfog. He was the acting U.S. attorney in Oregon, right? In August 2021, we informed him specifically, the senators did. We asked them to investigate these people for our based upon our allegations of criminal activity. Instead of him investigating them, he sent it to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice told the senators to kick rocks, right? Mm-hmm. Fast forward a year later, it's June 27th of this year. We filed our petition. Scott Asfog is now assigned to defend these people. All right. Now, if that's not good enough, it gets a little bit better. A couple weeks later, the Department of Justice reassigns him. They want him out of here. They want him out of here so bad, they reassign him to Nairobi, Kenya.
My old stomping ground almost.
So they did it within 4 days. Wow. So he's now out of the country. All right. As of July 17th, he's gone. So they assign now a new U.S. attorney. The new U.S. attorney requested or I should say Scott Asfog requested it, but the U.S. Attorney's Office requested an extension of time to August 26th, right? Now, when you request an extension and it gets granted by the court, you have to meet that deadline, no matter what.
So that they came and went, what happened?
They didn't meet the deadline. So we filed a motion for default judgment immediately after they missed the deadline. Steve Jonkis was right on it.
Nice.
And so what they then did was they filed their response a day late and they said, hey, my dog was sick. That's literally what they're attempting to tell the court. The reason that this is late is because for unforeseen circumstances, my dog was sick.
Wow. It's like my dog ate my homework.
It's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. So what we're doing right now is we are pushing forward a little bit on the default motion. We don't suspect that's going to work with the court because this is a match. We're not afraid of the fight. We want the fight. So it's, I don't want to necessarily win on a default. I want to win. So I'll take it. But what we are also doing is in parallel, putting together our response because they filed a motion to dismiss on really spacious arguments that weren't very cognizant, in my opinion, or professional. So we're going to annihilate them on that. We are ready. We've been preparing for this moment for a long time. And we got really lucky because Rochelle Walensky on the 17th, Rochelle Walensky, head of the CDC, gave us a gift. She gave us the gift of a quote. Let me read the quote for the audience. Okay, give me 1 second here. She said on August 17th, quote, to be frank, we, the CDC, are responsible for some pretty dramatic, pretty public mistakes from testing, and here's the key one, to data, to communications. When she admitted that they had made mistakes with data, you can't make mistakes with data as a federal agency.
Mm.
You have to abide by what's called the Information Quality Act and make sure all the data that is published is accurate. That is the charge of every single government agency, that the data published for public dissemination is accurate. So she just admitted fraud yet again. This is now the third time we've caught the CDC admitting fraud in terms of death certificates and data and things of that nature. So we have until September 12th to file our response. And that's why I asked you, said, hey, look, can I come back on? Because we want to invite the audience to join us in this fight.
How do they help?
Go to beyondthecon.com. That's beyondthecon.com, right on the homepage. And we just finished updating this last night. You will see that you can sign on to this petition, say, I support this petition. I want to see this grand jury investigate this issue. And what we get to do is amass all of these numbers. We're shooting for over a million Americans, at least a million Americans by September 12th, because then that allows us to go back to the court and tell the court our standard that we have to prove to the court is that there is significant public interest in seeing a grand jury investigation take place.
Awesome.
We already have over 150,000 people Americans just starting out. In the next 2 weeks, we can get this over a million, hopefully far over a million, and show the courts that there is significant public interest wanting to see a grand jury investigate these people for crimes, criminal data fraud, and willful misconduct. And we get to there, folks, we are going to bury them. And I can't wait. That's why I'm so excited. We are about to take this whole thing down with your help.
Wonderful. So folks, go to beyondthecon.com. And right on that front page, you're going to see the link to sign on to this petition. We can do this. We should do this. We need to do this. We must do this. Let's get this done. Thank you, Dr. H, for all your hard work. And I look forward to see what happens.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. And thank you, everybody out there listening. We love you so much. Thank you for fighting with us.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsinscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsinscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsinscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.